Sponsors Forum. I'm filling in for David Alkeck tonight. We're a non-for-profit organization, and we're dedicated to bringing philosophy, ideas, and intellectual discussion to the DFW area. We are all volunteer, no paid staff, and actually we're looking for some volunteers. So if anyone's interested in doing a little volunteer work, we would be thrilled. We're just, the board members are all a bunch of old white guys. And so we could use
some. I thought if you were going to have some paid staff, I'd volunteer. Yeah,
we could use some diversity. We could use some feminine charms and diversity. Anyway, but I'm Rob Olson, one of the directors, and I want to thank everybody for coming out. We meet on the second and the fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. And we want, if you enjoy this lecture, which I'm sure you will, please encourage your family and friends to come out. And it's always a mind-expanding experience, in my opinion. So any first-time visitors? Oh, wonderful. How'd you hear about us, ma'am?
My lovely sister.
Okay, so you've been, okay, great. And we have a youngster, we have a budding philosopher. How old is she?
5.
And what is your name, sweetie?
Zoe.
Okay, very good. So maybe we have a new, maybe in 20 years, Zoe will be speaking to our group as a philosophy professor. So if you haven't paid already, please do so immediately after the lecture. The cost is $5. David Drum, our treasurer, so if you came in before he got here, please pay him afterwards. Philosophy is not free. It's $5, the best bargain in town, and if you're a student with an ID, then your charge is $2. And we are not going to charge for Zoe. Zoe, there's no charge for Zoe. And then also, every once in a while, someone might inadvertently forget to pay their bill, and then we're stuck with it. So please remember to pay your bill when you leave, and be generous with the wait staff. We're starting to work on our spring schedule of 2018. We wish we had it all fully developed, we could pass it out, but keep looking at watching our website. And we are diligently working on that, right, guys? We are diligently working on getting some top-notch speakers for the spring schedule 2018. We have a website that we try and keep all this material up to date and the schedule. So look at that from time. You can sign up on our email list there. And then you can also sign up to get updates on meetings at www.meetup.com. Can they go on our website? There's a link to Meetup, so they can sign up for that
as well. I don't know if there's a link. I don't recall if there is a link on there. Okay. There might be.
You can go to Meetup and Philosopher's Forum or Philosophy Dallas, and you'll see us pretty quickly, I believe. Okay, so our, as we normally do, we ask our speaker to speak for about 45 minutes or so, and then we open up to questions. And so on your question, we ask you make a short statement, and then get to your question and try to avoid the Shakespearean soliloquies.
Oh yeah, there's a link.
Okay,
there's a link. Right.
And then lastly, please turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate mode at this time. We are really thrilled to have Dr. Cal Gilson here this evening with us. He has written extensively about the American dream and what that means. Dr. Gilson received his B.S. in political science from Oregon State University, and then was in the military for a couple of years, and then he earned his M.A. and Ph.D. degrees in government and politics from the University of Maryland College Park. He taught at LSU and the University of Colorado before joining the faculty at SMU here in Dallas in July of 1995 as professor and chair of the Department of Political Science. Dr. Gilson was the director of the John Goodwin Tower Center for Political Studies and chair of the department from 1996 to 2001. He teaches and writes in the area of American politics, American political thought, and Texas political thought, Texas politics. He's the author of 7 books. Is it 6? Okay, I thought that had gone out. Seven Jokes and the Editor of Seven More. His classic American Government text is used. It's in the 8th edition? Is that what you said?
9th
edition. Okay. He has to update that every 2 years. So a big, that's a big project. His interest is in the American founding has been pursued through other books. His two books on the American dream, Pursuing the American Dream, Opportunities and Exclusion Over 4 Centuries, and the American dream in history, politics, and fiction, explore the positive and negative influences of that classic idea on American political development. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Cal Gilson.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. We were trying to figure out, I know that I've been with this group at least once before, maybe a couple times before over the years, and I am sure that when this book, Pursuing the American Dream, came out in 2004, that I did talk with this group about it. So the second book on the American Dream is the one we're going to talk about today. But as was mentioned, I've written a number of books over the years, and some of those books are in their 7th edition or 9th edition, with the 10th coming out. This book is in its 3rd edition, and I had to bring it to you and just hold it up a little bit. It arrived in my desk today, so even when you've written a few books, it never gets old. When you get a new copy of a book, you've got to sort of hold it, leaf through it a little bit. And so this book is called Lone Star Tarnished, and its subtitle is A Critical Look at Texas Politics and Public Policy. I would refer to you to this book as Christmas gifts, but I looked and Amazon doesn't have it up yet, so I couldn't guarantee you that it would be available by Christmas. But if you've got a crazy uncle that is convinced that Texas is going to hell, he would probably want to read this book. This is a challenge to the Texas model. It's an argument that while Texas does have a commitment to small government, low taxes, that we're underfunding education and healthcare and a number of other things that make for a high quality of life. So it's a challenge to the Texas miracle idea that you hear a lot about. But the book we're going to talk about tonight is this one. It's called The American Dream in History, Politics, and Fiction. And I like this cover. You recognize this guy, right? That's Abraham Lincoln. He's easy enough for anyone to recognize. This is Mark Twain. Most of you would recognize him as well. But it's remarkably difficult to find a leading American political figure and a leading fiction author from the same period. You can think of the great American novelists, but oftentimes you won't have a picture of their face. You won't have an idea of what they look like. So you can't pair Franklin Roosevelt, say, with John Steinbeck, because, you know, there aren't very many people in the room that would readily recognize Steinbeck, even though everyone knows him and Grace of Wrath. So to pair Lincoln and Mark Twain made this cover distinctive, I think. And the title, The American Dream in History, Politics, and Fiction, came from a reconsideration of this book. If you look at the cover to this book, this is a famous painting about Manifest Destiny and about the American settlement of the continent. And so it's got the Lady Liberty leading pioneers, wagon trains, the railroad is following. So the idea in this book was that the American dream has been a guiding ideal of the country from its founding. That it was discussed by John Winthrop in old Puritan times, 1630, and all the American presidents forward on the idea that the American dream is distinctive. It's the promise that Americans have more opportunity, more readily available than people anywhere else in the world, to realize their capabilities and to draw out the best that's in them and to succeed. Even though, as we say that, we realize that for much of American history, we weren't talking about blacks, we weren't talking about Hispanics, we weren't talking about women, but that ideal of the American dream is something that the country has espoused throughout its history. And what I did in this book is to say that while that's true, there are periods in American history when the American dream did seem to be relatively broadly and relatively easily available, if only to white men initially and to more groups later on. And you can think about the first half of the 19th century as a period in which land and opportunity were widely available to anyone who wanted to seize it. You can think about the Progressive Era, the first couple decades of the 20th century, or you can think about the post-World War II decades when many of us in this room grew up. I was born in 1949. Some of you were born a couple years later. Others born in the 50s and 60s. And that quarter century from the end of World War II to the early years of the 1970s were years in which employment was generally full, jobs were available. People on one income, generally men, could feed their families, take care of their families, send their kids to school, and maybe send their kids to college. But the last 40 years, the early 1970s into our own time, is one of those periods in American history where people have the sense that no matter how hard they try, no matter how hard they work, the dream recedes in front of them. They might live paycheck to paycheck. They can't save, they can't invest, maybe they can't send their kids to college. And so there is that dispiriting sense that the story that the country tells about opportunity being widely available is not necessarily true. And our own time is not the only period in American history where that has been true. You think of the age of the robber barons, you think of the Great Depression into the World War II era. So the argument of this book was that the American dream has been an ideal of the country throughout its history, sometimes more readily available than others, but always present to be restored, to be recaptured by a new administration with new policies that might make opportunity more broadly available. And that book was published in 2004. And so at its 10th anniversary, the publisher, University of Kansas Press, emailed me and said, "Gilson, your book is now 10 years old. It's still in print. You know, some people have been reading it. Why don't you do a revised edition and add a chapter on the Obama years, right? Add another chapter on the end about the most recent period and what President Obama meant for the American dream." And I said, well, you know, at the end of that book, I made a series of policy prescriptions for how to rejuvenate the American dream after that 40-year period in which many people thought that they didn't have the opportunity that allowed them to get ahead. And I said, well, since I made those policy prescriptions, nobody cared, nobody listened, they didn't pass them into law, and the American dream was not restored. So let me look at it differently this time. Rather than telling the same story, let me see whether or not the argument for the American dream, whether the sort of official elite political and social presentation of the nature of the country as one in which opportunity is broadly available and anyone who wants to pursue it has the opportunity to do that and to succeed. Let me see whether there is another narrative, sort of the official narrative of our political, social, and economic elites saying opportunity is broadly available. And if you pursued it and you failed, it's because of something wrong with you. It's because you weren't smart enough, you didn't get enough education, you didn't work hard enough, you drank too much, and you failed, and that's your responsibility. The country made opportunity available, and you didn't get it. That's your fault. And So the last thing here, fiction, is that second narrative. It is the challenge to the official narrative of opportunity being broadly available. And so I said to the press, I'd rather write a different book in which I do retell the story of the official version of the American Dream, adding that new chapter on Obama, but I also present what I thought would be a mixed picture in fiction, that some fiction would show the American Dream pursued triumphantly, that people in fiction would win, would see opportunity, would pursue it, and would achieve greatly and enjoy the fruits of that success. And I also assumed that there would be other of our great fiction in which the American Dream would recede, that people would pursue it, but they would fail. And in fact, I found that there is no example in our great literature of successful pursuit of the American Dream. There is no great book in American literature that presents aspiration, effort, accomplishment, success, and the enjoyment into the end of life of the fruits of that success. Horatio Alger wrote a series of books in the middle of the 19th century about how young people should prepare to pursue the American Dream. There are 50 Horatio Alger novels, in which Ragged Dick, his most famous one, is a novel about a young man who is initially living on the street and then does come in contact with good older examples of achievement and success, and steadily builds his own success, working hard, saving money, renting a room rather than living on the streets, opening a saving account, finding a church, all those sort of building blocks to success, Ragged Dick does achieve and accomplish. But nobody really considers Ragged Dick to be great literature. And when I talk about great American fiction, I'm talking about James Fenimore Cooper, the Leather Stocking series. I'm talking about Hawthorne, Melville, Twain, Irving, all the way up to John Updike and people like that. So in our great fiction, there is no example of the American Dream as an aspiration being achieved and enjoyed. Now, as I was preparing to write this book, there is one broadly acknowledged piece of great American fiction that I thought might be a challenge to that thesis, and that was To Kill a Mockingbird, right? You think of To Kill a Mockingbird as mixed, as Atticus Finch being a great man in difficult circumstances, a small southern town, Gadsden, Alabama, near Gadsden, Alabama. Something going on in Alabama tonight. If you have cell phones, right, do feel free to check them every once in a while. I'll be interested to know when you find out what happened. But Atticus Finch, in the 30s and 40s, small town Alabama, in To Kill a Mockingbird, seemed to behave nobly, right? He did defend the black sharecropper who was charged with and then convicted with rape of a white woman. But just two or three years ago, a new book, To Set a Watchman, is that the title, To Set a Watchman? Came out. And that was the first draft of Mockingbird that was rejected by the publisher as too dark. And then Mockingbird was written, and this To Set a Watchman was discovered in a desk drawer and published about 3 years ago. And in it, Atticus Finch is not a great man. He's not a man that protects the weak and the vulnerable. He associates himself with the KKK and the White Citizens Council, and is part of his social milieu, as almost all of us are, right? So I don't worry so much about To Kill a Mockingbird anymore, because the book that she wanted to write was Ghost and a Watchman, and it told a darker story. So what I'm going to do with the bulk of our time tonight is to outline the dominant narrative of American political and economic life, the elite narrative, the American dream, as opportunity widely available to anyone who will take it up and strive to succeed, but then spend most of our time in going through some of the themes from our great American literature about the difficulties that get in the way and very frequently destroy effort, destroy success before it can be realized, and even after it's realized. So let me talk a little bit about the dominant narrative of American elite social, political, and economic, about the nature of the country and how the country has been and should be set up to provide widespread opportunity to the public. This is the idea of American exceptionalism and of the story of Benjamin Franklin and Horatio Alger, that effort well spent, even if not at first successful, will lead to success if people pursue it over time. And so there are three images that have been used to describe the nature of the American society and its responsibility to make opportunity broadly available to the public. So these three images are old, venerable, very frequently used by American political leaders and others. The first one is America as a city on a hill, America as a living example to the rest of the world. That idea of America as a city on a hill was first articulated by John Winthrop, the Puritan governor, in 1630 on board the Arabella, the flagship of the three-ship Puritan fleet, as it's at anchor in Boston Harbor before the Puritans go ashore. John Winthrop gives a homily in which he describes the Puritan mission as to establish a city on a hill, a light unto the world, an example to the world of Christian life, of how Christians should organize their society. And that idea of a city on a hill has been articulated by many political leaders, including John Kennedy, very famously in a set of speeches he gave to the Massachusetts legislature and to the nation in his inaugural address in early 1961. But the most famous use of the city on a hill image or analogy is by Ronald Reagan. And I want to read it to you because it shows you the distance that we have, what shall we say, descended since 1989 when Ronald Reagan gave this speech to more recent times. And so Ronald Reagan, in his farewell address in early 1989, after 8 years as president, in which he had described the city on a hill many times, said this. He said, "I've spoken of the shining city all my political life. In my mind, it was a tall, proud city built on rocks and stronger than oceans, windswept, God blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds. And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here. After 200 years, she's still a beacon, still a magnet for all who must have freedom, for all the pilgrims from all the lost places who are hurtling through the darkness toward home." For years, I couldn't read that without choking up, without getting a lump in my throat. All the pilgrims hurtling through the darkness toward home. And home was freedom. Home was liberty. Home was America. hurling through the darkness toward home and see it crash into the wall. So, you know, the door, if there have to be doors, the doors are open to everyone who loves freedom. So I love that that Reagan quote. There are two more images that are central to the American dream. They're more substantive, describing the kind of country that we are committed to be. And the second image is of a balance between the dollar and the man. This is an image that was central to Andrew Jackson, but have been used by many other American presidents, all the way up to Theodore Roosevelt, Herbert Hoover, and others. And there's a quote from a man named Orestes Brownson, who was in Andrew Jackson's kitchen cabinet. He was a journalist and a philosopher of a sort, and a wise man to Andrew Jackson. And this idea of a balance between the dollar and the man, he says, "We believe that property should be held subordinate to man and not man to property, and therefore that it is always lawful to make such modification of property's constitution as the good of humanity requires." That's the idea that in law and policy, the country is committed to a balance between property and opportunity, the dollar and the man. And if the dollar becomes too powerful, the man loses opportunity. The next generation loses opportunity. And the idea that property's constitution, property's legal description and makeup, inheritance laws, usury laws, you know, all kinds of the progressive income tax, the estate tax or the death taxes, as you prefer. Those are property's constitution. That's the legal description of property and how it is moved from person to person and generation to generation. And Brownson is saying that society and politics have the right to revise the legal constitution of property if it becomes large enough to pose a threat to individual opportunity. And the reason Theodore Roosevelt liked that was trust busting, right? That property, in his view, had become dangerously large and needed to be redefined. And the third image of American opportunity and how government should try to craft it so it's broadly available is the idea of the fairly run race. This is an image that Abraham Lincoln used, Roosevelt used, LBJ used it in the 1960s and others as well. And that's the idea that if people are not prepared fairly to toe the starting line of a race, if some runners are well-trained, well-fed, and prepared to compete, and others are brought up to the line in shackles or with the abilities, and the starting gun goes off, the fact that these guys finished before these guys, nobody considers fair. The race was not fairly run because people weren't sort of commonly prepared, if not entirely equally prepared, to contest that race. So the American society's commitment is to ensure that Zoe and other young kids are brought into public education that is of sufficient quality to give everybody the educational and training opportunities to compete successfully later in life. And so society's responsibility is to make sure that people reach early adulthood legitimately prepared to compete, and we need to craft policy to be sure that that's the case. So the traditional view of the American dream is that if we do that, and to the extent that we do that, and the assurance is given that we do provide that equal opportunity, that the results of the race or the competition should be considered to be fair. But in this most recent book, I have looked at our great American novels, our classic fiction, and found that virtually none of them believe that the American dream of preparation, of education, of training, and of competition, in which even if you fail, you get up, dust yourself off, and compete again, is an adequate explanation of the world that we live in. And so I looked at the fiction to see what forces. There's a phrase from Ralph Waldo Emerson called The Lords of Life. And it's a poem in which Emerson is saying that people are small, people are weak and vulnerable, and the lords of life tower over them and determine their opportunities and the results of their efforts. And for Emerson, the lords of life were nature, disaster, right? Race, gender, class, cultural constraints that allow some people to strive and preclude others from competing. So I want to talk to you about some of our great literature and give you some examples of what it looks like, what those lords of life, those forces at large in the world that can pummel and in many cases destroy the best laid plans and the most noble effort. And the first set are chance and fate. Chance and fate. I'm talking mostly about novels here, but there's one short story that I'm going to start with. It's by Nathaniel Hawthorne. It's called The Ambitious Guest, and it was written in 1835, very near the beginning of his career. And it's a story, it'll come right up on the internet, just type in the title, and the title is The Ambitious Guest, very short. And it's a story of a young man, healthy, vibrant, energetic, well-prepared, and excited to launch himself into the world, who is hiking through the White Mountains of New Hampshire. It's cold, it's a winter night, and he sees lights in a window. And so he knocks on the door seeking shelter, and there's a family sitting around a hearth, a fireplace, couple of generations, a young girl, a child, husband and wife, and a grandmother. And he describes to that family his excitement about launching himself into the world, about the sense that he's going to achieve great things. He's not sure what they are, but he knows that people will remember him at the end of his life. And the family describes their hopes and dreams. And on the road outside, a wagon goes by with revelers in it. They've been out drinking. They're having a good time. They're singing loudly. And they look at the light and they think, maybe we'll stop here too. But they decide not to. They're going to go on to the town. So you get this raucous singing going on down the road. And the family has built its home in a relatively vulnerable place in the notch of the White Mountains. And there are rock slides on occasion. And so they've built a shelter that they can sprint to in the case of danger. And so in the middle of the night, there comes a rumbling down the side of the mountain. A big rock slide is on its way, and the family and the young traveler sprint toward the safety of the shelter. As the avalanche comes down the hill, it divides, and it goes around the house and catches them before they can reach the shelter, killing them all. The revelers, the drunks, have driven on by and made it into town. They might have headaches, but they're fine, right? And if they had just stayed in the house, they would have been fine too. But they sprinted for the shelter, the avalanche caught them and killed them all. Chance. It's a chance world. you're philosophers, so you're not going to appreciate this nearly as much as I do. But my favorite bumper sticker of all the time is very brief. It says, shit happens. It does, right? And so chance, no matter how well laid your plans are, nature or chance can intervene. Fate is even more prominent. And here we can talk about Melville's Moby Dick from 1851, Ahab, and his contest, his challenge to the white whale that he cannot break off, even though people know that his fate is to fall to that whale and take his whole ship with him. There are two quotes in Moby Dick that I want to share with you that I think are really interesting in regard to the power of fate. To channel human aspiration, to preclude options that might be better taken. The first one is, and this is philosophy, by the way, chance, free will, and necessity. No wise incompatible. All interweaving work together. The mingling threads of life are woven by warp and woo. Calms crossed by storms, a storm for every calm. There is no steady, unretracing progress in this life. Ifs eternally. That life is ifs eternally. And a second one, Melville, Moby Dick, he writes, you think Billy Budd, he writes a lot about life at sea. And this is his view of the world and of life in it. He says, the world's a ship on its passage out, not on its voyage complete. One most perilous voyage ended only begins a second, and a second ended only begins a third, and so on forever and for aye. Such is the endlessness, yea, the intolerableness of all earthly effort. Now you think of Ragged Dick and Horatio Alger and the idea of accomplishment, building towards success, enjoying the fruits of that success. And Melville says that life is ifs eternally, and that effort is endless and intolerable because it never culminates. It never succeeds. It never gives you the opportunity to sit and enjoy. And so the ideas of chance and fate are prominent in our great novels. So is the idea that culture constrains many. And part of our American history is that cultural constraints have loosened, and that persons who were previously excluded are now included, at least to some degree, in the American story of aspiration and effort and potential success. But that culture constrains opportunity to some, denies it to others. And one of the best examples of that is Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, 1850, which many of you will know as the story of Hester Prynne, a young Puritan woman, and Arthur Dimmesdale, a Puritan minister. In Boston in the 1640s. How many of you read The Scarlet Letter in high school? Almost all of you. There is no place for Hester Prynne's choice, for her freedom, for her liberty, for her right to love and be loved. And so she is defined as a woman in Boston in the 1840s. And as she steps outside the definition of appropriate behavior for persons of her type, she is punished by her community. But more importantly, Arthur Dimmesdale, the minister, is never able to acknowledge and seize freedom. Hester Prynne calls on him to think more broadly, to leave his role in Boston society, run away with her, and he can't do it. But at the end of the day, Hester Prynne has her illegitimate child, takes that child to Europe and gets it established in a less judgmental environment, and then returns to Boston and to her home on the periphery of the city, restores the egg to her chest, and lives out the rest of her life because she too believes that the cultural definitions and constraints of her time are right and true and apply to Dimmesdale and to her. And so Dimmesdale dies first, she dies later, and she has herself buried beside Dimmesdale, but with an appropriate distance, so that their ashes cannot mingle even in death. That, you know, they were living according to the culture of their time. Many, many examples like that. Mark Twain is one of our greatest American authors. And Mark Twain was mean. He enjoyed mean in a, you know, devilishly clever kind of way. He enjoyed tweaking Horatio Alger. Twain was a great writer. Horatio Alger, not such a great writer, but the most prominent Alger novel is Ragged Dick, and it's 1858, I think, maybe 68, and within it, it's got to be 68, because in the early 1970s, Mark Twain writes a series of short pieces, one called The Good Boy Who Did Not Succeed, and the other called The Bad Boy Who Succeeded. The bad boy who succeeded ended up in the legislature. Stole, did all sorts of nasty stuff. But he was tweaking Horatio Alger's Ragged Dick in the sense that you can build yourself into a member of society in good standing. And so he wrote these little pieces, The Good Boy Who Did Not Succeed and The Bad Boy Who Did Succeed. But that theme runs all through his major books. So if you think about Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, those are great books, but so is a third book by Mark Twain called Pudd'nhead Wilson. Anybody ever hear of Pudd'nhead Wilson? Yeah. That is a book in which Twain is taking on the idea of race and showing that culture is even more powerful than race in shaping one's position in society. And so in Pudd'nhead Wilson, one of the leading characters is Roxy. And Roxy is 1/16th black. And she traces her heritage, apocryphally traces her heritage back to Captain John Smith, Pocahontas, right? Captain John Smith in early Virginia. And white male progenitors, and decreasingly black, but still with black blood, slave women, till you get to Roxy, who's 15/16th white and 1/16th black, but legally a slave, because born of a slave mother. And so Mark Twain says, Roxy looked as white as anyone, says this, to all intents and purposes, Roxy was as white as anybody. But the 1/16th of her that was black outvoted the other 15 parts that made her a Negro. She was a slave and saleable as such. Her child, 31 parts white, and he too was a slave, and by the fiction of law and custom, a Negro. And so the story that Mark Twain is telling, and the story ends with Roxy having been a servant in a white home, and there is, the white homeowner has a baby, she has a baby, they look very similar, the guy's wife dies, he's distraught, and so Roxy switches the babies in their cradles because the master has threatened to sell his slaves down the river, meaning to Simon Legree in Mississippi, right? Down the river, much worse, and so she switches the babies. Her baby is raised as the white heir to that prominent family in town, and the white heir is raised as a black slave, saleable young man, although they look very similar. And when the switch is unmasked at the end of the novel, the apparent heir kills himself because he's got black blood, and the real heir, who's been raised as a slave, has addiction, has a level of literacy, has a total social makeup and composite that doesn't permit him to move in the white world. So both are destroyed. And the way the cultural assumptions with which they are raised define them even more than race does. So Twain is great because he's he takes on shibboleths. He takes on assumptions. And rather than talk about slavery directly or talk about you know, a person who are half white and half black, he takes it down to 1/32nd black and 31/32nd white to the eye, and shows the power of cultural presumptions about race. As you can well imagine, race runs throughout our great American novels. Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin, has a great line in it. The black characters in Uncle Tom's Cabin are George. George, Eliza, and their child, Harry. George is an accomplished, literate, productive, useful black slave who works in a factory, and although a slave, has directing responsibility because of his intelligence and his work ethic. But his master sees him enjoying and taking pride in his work, and so he takes him out of that role, puts him in agricultural labor to break him, because he can't have that self-image. And Eliza overhears her kind owner, who's indebted, saying to a slave trader that he will sell Harry, 3-year-old Harry, to the slave trader. And so they run. Middle of the winter, the famous scene of Eliza with Harry in her arms walking the ice floes across the Ohio River to freedom in Ohio. George says, what's the use of our trying to do anything, trying to know anything, trying to be anything? What's the use of living? I wish I was dead. But they do run, they do make it, they end up in Canada and then in Europe and become educated and successful with no desire to return to America. One of the parts of Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin that made it so controversial is that she has George saying at the end of that novel, why would I want to go back there? They don't want me, I don't want them, to hell with them. And the critique was, well, why couldn't you make George wish for a better America in which he could feel at home, rather than say to hell with them? But to hell with them seems pretty right, you know, from his perspective. So another example of that complete denial of the opportunity that is represented by the American dream comes in Richard Wright's Native Son from 1940, in which he has Bigger Thomas, the lead character in that book. And many of you read that, I'm sure, in college as well, maybe before. Bigger Thomas says, why should I want to do anything? I ain't got a chance. I don't know nothing. I'm just black, and they make the laws. They don't give black people a chance, so I took a chance and lost. So that idea that opportunity is completely and thoroughly denied to broad chunks of the American population through most of American history, and that includes to women. There are, and I'll try to do this quickly so I don't run completely out of time. the place of women within the American society and the opportunity structure of American society is pursued in James Fenimore Cooper's books, but I think more familiarly in Sister Carrie, Theodore Dreiser of 1900, Sister Carrie. Carrie, at 18, leaves her family in downstate Illinois, sort of small town Illinois, goes to Chicago, where she has a sister and the sister's husband to live with while she looks for work in Chicago. And on the first page of Sister Carrie, Theodore Dreiser says, "When a girl leaves home at 18, she does one of two things. Either she falls into saving hands and becomes better, or she rapidly assumes the cosmopolitan standard of virtue and becomes worse." Notice that there's no option of preparation, of hard work, of promotion, of success. She either falls into saving hands, she finds a good husband who gives her a good home, or it's the street. She falls to the only available asset at the price on offer. And so Theodore Dreiser has Carrie at the disposal first of George Drouet, a salesman, and then a man named Dewhurst. And so she gives herself to these guys seeking marriage all along. They deny it, but she keeps her head above water until she gets to New York and Dewhurst goes under. She takes a singing career and becomes quite famous, becomes quite wealthy, but unfulfilled. And so the end of Sister Carrie is her sitting in an opulent hotel room in a rocking chair, looking out the window, wondering when her boat will come in, when she'll be made whole by husband and family, which was what whole meant for women during that period. And there is one Horatio Alger book that has a woman as the lead character. There are other Horatio Alger books that have women in them, but the most famous has a young girl passing as a boy on the street to be safe, because a girl alone on the street would not be safe. So she dressed up as a boy and passed as a boy successfully until she was saved, and then she identified herself as a girl. But there is a novel called Helen Ford. And again, this is available on the internet. It's an interesting book. And in it, Alger has Helen Ford and a woman that is close to her doing piecework sewing, sewing for a living. What women could do in the 19th century was women's work, even when they weren't doing it at home, so they could take in laundry, they could run a boarding house, they could work in a restaurant, they could make clothes, or they could sing. And so she starts off doing piecework sewing. And that is the most, that's what Carrie Meeber did as her first job. And it's what made her so receptive to Drouet saying, "Come live with me," because it was so hard and so sort of soul bleeding to do piecework sewing. And this is what Horatio Alger says about women's options in the middle of the 19th century. "Perhaps no employment is more confining and more poorly compensated than that of sewing. The narrow choices allowed to women who are compelled to labor for their livelihood enables employers to establish a disgracefully low scale of prices." So while Ragged Dick could work his way up and go to work in a counting house, a business, and grow into success and security, that wasn't available to Helen Ford, and even Horatio Alger knew it. And there's one line in Toni Morrison. You've read Toni Morrison's Beloved, most likely. There's a second book called Sula, which I would recommend to you as well. And there's a line in Sula where Sula and Nell are young black girls from pre-teen through the end of their lives, so they know each other over the course of 50 years, and they're very close, and they fall apart and come back together somewhat at the end of the novel. And this is what Toni Morrison says about the two of them. Sula and Nell both, quote, had discovered years before that they were neither white nor male, and that all freedom and triumph was forbidden to them. So this idea of opportunity over much of American history applies to some, but radically not to others. If we had a little more time, I'll talk to you about John Steinbeck, Grapes of Wrath, the role of class within the American economy. But I want to move to some recent novels. All of the Pulitzer Prize winning sort of great, more recent novels that discuss the ennui, if you know that word, the sort of depleting character of small town life. And so there are several novels that do that. John Updike's Rabbit series are set in eastern Pennsylvania, and Rabbit is a character that is traced in four books, two of which won the Pulitzer Prize by John Updike. He is successful in a sense on other people's previous efforts. He assumes managership of his wife's father's car dealership, and so he can live comfortably. He's a member of a country club for a while in the Rabbit series, but he's never fulfilled. He's never feeling accomplished. He's never feeling as if he is driving his own fate and future. Richard Russo, Empire Fails, Falls. Anybody know that book? Richard Russo, Empire Falls. I thought it must be a book about the falling of the Berlin Wall or something like that. It's about a small New Hampshire mill town called Empire Falls. And there is a woman who owns all the premier property in the town, all the mills, very wealthy, even though the mills are now gone. Most people have very few options in that town. Everyone is at her disposal. And it's how people feel life closing in. And there's a famous scene of a now divorced couple in the football stands of a high school football game, in which they're looking at the young athletes on the field, the prime of their strength, of their young manhood, crashing into each other, and the young cheerleaders on the sidelines, slim, lithe, cartwheels, looking at life as if it holds everything for them, and they look at each other and say, 5 years from now, you know, heavy bills, the car's going to break down, she's going to be pregnant, he's going to be drinking. They, you know, they've got nothing to look forward to. So life in the small town is debilitating in these stories. But it's not just in fiction. And we're going to be to how President Trump won the election here in just a minute. There is also in some really first-rate social science over the last half century, but particularly over the last 15 years, that talk about the same thing, about the hollowing out of opportunity in much of America. You see it in your newspapers all the time as the city's booming, the city's creating the vast amount, the vast proportion of American value. Small towns. Now, I grew up in a town of 7,000 people in Oregon. It was a mill town at the time. Everybody had jobs. They could take care of their families. All those mills are gone, right? And so in small towns all over the country, young people have the choice of hunkering down and trying to get on at the electric shop or, you know, some little business in town, or driving into a major city, or moving, as millions of Texans did over the last 50 years, out of the countryside into the city. And so just a couple of books, one of them by a man named Robert Putnam, who's a political science professor at Harvard. He wrote a book who you probably didn't read. I haven't read it. But it's called Bowling Alone. So the title makes it famous. And it's about the breakdown of American, the networking of American life. That people in the 50s and 60s and 70s were in bowling leagues and other kinds of civic groups and organizations that they felt were their community and that they felt at home and accepted in, and that much of that is now broken down. And so the title of the book is Bowling Alone. A new book that he wrote, that book's about 12 years old, a new book is called Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. And he went back to the town that he grew up in and went to high school in, Fort Clinton, Ohio. And he looked at the generation that he grew up with in a healthy small town that then went on to do responsible and sometimes even great things, and the kids growing up in that same small town over the course of the last 10 years. Opioid crisis, all of that kind of stuff, you know, dropout rates, jobs disappearing, and said, you know, what are we doing to future generations? We had a society that built the opportunity to succeed 50 years ago. We don't seem to have that for many people now. One book I would not encourage you to read is Thomas Piketty. He's a French economist. It's called Capital in the 21st Century. I see you nodding your head, but I'm willing to bet you didn't get through the 550 pages. Did you? The thesis of that book, and it is a crutch, the thesis of that book is that at the beginning of the 20th century, America had much less income inequality than did Europe, but today we have more income inequality than Europe does, and so this, you know, top 1%, top 1/10th of 1% that you hear a lot about. So that's the thesis there, and then there's one more. There's a guy named Raj Chetty, who is also an economist, used to be at Harvard, now out at Stanford, and he has the concept of income heritability. And that is the idea that if you're born up here into a relatively comfortable, prominent family, it moves you through Highland Park High School to SMU on to, somebody already started kind of someone, so you can't do that. But, you know, two, you're comfortably moving through the upper levels of society. But if you are born into a family at the lower bound, and you move through a poor school into a low-paying job and your family has no ability to send you to college, then that's income heritability. You inherit the top or you inherit the bottom, much less movement. And the whole idea of the American dream was premised on the idea that mobility was possible. That if you planned well, worked hard, educated yourself, you could do anything. And so there's a lot of social science that says that that's no longer as true as it once was. It's not untrue, but less true. And if you think about Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and that white working class vote that went to Obama in 8 and 12 and went to Trump in 16 because Trump says, I'm bringing those jobs back. We're going to be paying attention to you guys. Mostly Trump won because 92% of regular Republicans ended up voting for him, even if they said they had reservations. Same proportion of Democrats voted for Hillary Clinton, even if they had reservations. But there was movement of non-college white working class voters in those industrial states in the old Midwest that turned the election to Trump. So I think Trump said something. It's hard to imagine how. From Trump Tower, he had a better feel for small town Ohio and Pennsylvania. It's not hard to understand how he had a better feel than Clinton. And I do think that Cruz and Sanders had a sense that something was going on out there, too. But I don't think either Bush or Clinton did, and he benefited from it. So I hope I didn't go on too long. Be happy to talk about anything that's on your mind, including literature, the American dream, or what happened in Alabama. Anybody know? Has there been anything on the public early report?
It's a draw. Okay, so let's...
It can't be a draw. Somebody has to.
So far, it'll be a recount.
Yes. Okay, so let's open up to questions. Yes, back here.
On the matter of literature, isn't it possible that especially in the 20th century, since Tolstoy himself, when he saw his first silent black and white film, said film is going to be the dominant art form of the 20th century? Could it be that even caring about books and things that you have to spend a lot of time reading, when, as we all know, the American expression is time and money, that really movies, for example, would be a better measure of American literature in terms of optimism or pessimism? And that we're there, you have lots of success stories where you start out from humble beginnings and end up doing well, and people tend not to want to spend their money on movies that depress them and make them want to kill themselves. So and even if you look at literature, isn't it possible that the quote intellectuals unquote that run universities and so forth simply have a very depressed view of life and very different view than an optimistic American view? And they look at Horatio Alger stuff and simply define that as poor literature, just as they would have done on Dickens, even, who was a rock star in his era. The whole Supreme Court went to hear him during the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson himself went to hear him, because his own life story resembled so much of what Dickens wrote about. So isn't it possible that we're just looking at this from an intellectual's view, from the university view, rather than what most people define as themselves as defined as great literature?
Yeah, first, I am a big fan of books. I don't make movies, so I do write books, so I have to sort of stick with books. But I'm making sure that there's an opportunity for a third book on the American Dream, in which I might do politics, fiction, and movies in the next one. So, yeah, but I don't, I think that that books have always been taken as the more serious, the more thoughtful, the deeper analysis. You can think of that Piketty book, 500 pages, all the data in the world in there, and you can make a movie that is thematic, that has a point, but I don't think that movies have or should replace books. But there is the idea that the idea of the American dream is much beloved by Americans, because we hope that it's true. We want it to be true. And at some points in our history, it has been more true than at other points in our history. And this is one of those points where a lot of people feel like the American dream is slipping away.
Question here. I wonder if you think that the Fountainhead might be worthy of consideration as an exception to that word.
Yeah, I have... I did not read The Fountainhead before I wrote the book, but in talking about the book, I've gotten that question several times. My initial response is the sort of smart-ass college professor university response that virtually no one considers The Fountainhead to be great literature. But it does come up on the top of lists of great books by the public, right? Which is your point. And so I did read The Fountainhead, and I read Atlas Shrugged. Suckers. So yes, I have read it as well. And so the American Dream is the sort of Benjamin Franklin, Horatio Alger, embedded within your community and successful within that community, paying back. You remember how, if you read right again, that at several points, successful men taking interest in him, lifting up and carrying to the next stage. Mr. Rockwell, when Dick jumps into the Hudson, saves his sons. Mr. Rockwell gives him money and a job in a counting house. And the end of the book is, I'm on my way. So it's that paying back, it's that sense of community, which is completely lacking in the Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, because it's very individualistic. So, you know, I don't think it's the American dream in that sense.
Question here in the back.
Well, I too was thinking while you were talking about the disparity between the messages conveyed in the novels that you mentioned and what is conveyed in visual media and movies and television. And then I was thinking backward to the time period when this concept was emerging of an American dream. What mechanisms existed before there was film to sort of percolate that into our culture, assuming it was actually there?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I also, Thoreau's quote, you didn't mention, that a massive, many lives in quiet desperation. So, assuming that what he said was true, then maybe there was a cynical view of the American dream even then.
Yeah.
But what were the media that helped to define, to create this image of the American dream being possible?
Yeah. The phrase, the American dream, is first used in a book by a guy named James Truslow Adams in the Depression years, 1934, I think is the year. And he sort of describes it in a full-blown way. But the idea of the American dream, you can find all the way back into very early American history. You can find the components of the idea of the American dream without the phrase. And you can even sort of find the phrase, not the American dream, but Hector St. John de Crevecoeur, so 1780s, has "What is this new man, the American?" And he talks about the dream of freedom and liberty and opportunity, that sort of thing. So you can find the description of the American dream without the phrase going all the way back into the colonial period and coming forward, but you don't find the phrase itself until the Depression era and the first films. If you think about what's that KKK film that Wilson watched? Birth of a Nation. So films are the first couple decades of the 19th century, of the 20th century, excuse me. And so they are around by the time the phrase is actually invented. But I think it's most prominent in books going all the way back.
Question back here, Dr. Gilson.
I'm kind of battling allergies, so I'm going to cough a little bit. So excuse me. I was saying, what do you think the American dream means when black intellectuals, this elite, had to leave America in the late 1800s and the early 1900s to find success and fame in Europe?
Yes.
Instead of finding it at home.
Yeah. Yeah. The great black poet of the middle decades of the 20th century said the dream stinks like rotten meat. What?
Langston Hughes.
Yeah, Langston Hughes. Thank you very much. Yes. And so you find George in the 1850s. Choosing to go to Europe and saying, no, I don't want to go back. I wouldn't go back if they invited me. And you get black intellectuals throughout the 20th century. Langston Hughes leaves, come back, stays, but he writes about the American dream as completely denied, as bogus, completely bogus to black Americans. And is right. And over the course of the 20th century, second half of the 20th century, as the country has partially opened up to minorities, as we won't be able to call people in Texas very much longer, and women become more involved in the mainstream of the American economy, but not fully involved. So you know, I read a book, I just finished it over the weekend, another one of these damn things like this, called Blue Texas, about the Democratic coalition in Texas in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, which was black, Hispanic, labor coming together to elect Ralph Yarborough and a couple of other people before collapsing in the post-Kennedy assassination period. And so the struggle for involvement by blacks and Hispanics and women and others is ongoing and incomplete.
Okay, yeah. I have a quick question myself. To what extent do you believe the Me Too movement for sexual harassment and the legalization of gay marriage, to what extent do you think those have expanded the opportunity for the American dream?
Barely. Particularly gay marriage. I think that the idea of equality, of opportunity, and the right to marry who you will is critically important, but is fought at every turn still. In Texas, the denial of marriage insurance and other kinds of rights. So most fights for inclusion are decades-long, centuries-long, and almost always incomplete. That one will go on for a very long time. Otherwise, Roy Moore would not be competitive for a Senate seat from Alabama. The Me Too movement is a remarkable thing, but inchoate at this point. It's very important that women have the opportunity to move in society in comfort and security and confidence. But we're not making distinctions at this point between Franken and Moore, Franken and Trump, Franken and Weinstein. And so it seems to me that we're in the heat of the moment, and anything that suggests bad behavior is all clustered together. And so I hope we continue the conversation that, you know, it has a real kind of leavening sense in all of us that consider ourselves good people, because there's not a man my age that can't look back on 3 or 4 or 40 occasions in life in which you did something that, you know, that wasn't exactly the right thing to do. You know, and I mean it. There's nobody in the room who, you know, that's... Yeah.
Thank you very much. We have quick time for two more questions, this gentleman, and then Jack.
I wonder if you had a comment on the role of the positive thinking movement on the promotion of the right of drink.
Yeah. Remind me of the guy's name in the 30s and 40s that sort of the origins of that positive thinking.
Norman Vincent Peale.
Yes. Yeah, Norman Vincent Peale. You know, what I look at very closely is the top line message to the reading public in Great American Novels. And I did recognize that there are other levels of literature that are sometimes much more broadly influential and important in a particular time. They don't have the longevity of a Twain. But they do have a tremendous impact on their own time. But they tend to be more evanescent. And although you do have, you know, wealth ministries, right, today.
Prosperity churches.
That idea that God wants you to be wealthy, or if you just channel your mental effort, you too can be either well-liked or very successful. Those are powerful, and people want to believe them as well. But they tend, I think, not to have a longevity.
Okay, last question.
So I was challenged by some people to back think of a movie that might have made some kind of, or given some indication of where things have gone, certainly in our lifetime. And I came up with the one, and you'll recognize it immediately. But remember in the late 60s, maybe early 70s, but late 60s, there were a number of movies that were coming out in that time. We referred to them as statement movies. They had some kind of idea or statement to make about the culture, society. And the one I'm thinking of is The Graduate. So you might elaborate.
Well, how many of you saw The Graduate? this last question, but I am going to end it by talking about No Country for Old Men, which I saw for the first time just a few days ago, speaking about where we may have ended up. The Graduate is a movie in which Dustin Hoffman plays a young man from a wealthy, successful family that has graduated from college and is at loose ends, floating in the pool, waiting for life to present him with an opportunity, no motivation, no direction. And Mrs. Robinson, a family friend, distracts him temporarily. And he ends up getting the girl at the end of the movie. But that idea, that is the idea that is in the Rabbit series. An idea that social scientists like Daniel Bell and others, Bell wrote a book called The Post-Industrial Society. And it was about what happens to the striving model of American life in the presence of affluence, in the presence of inherited wealth, of generations that can give their children everything they want and need. Is that child going to have the fire in the belly that allowed the parents and the grandparents to build companies and to build the country? And so I think the statement in that movie is that the younger generation doesn't have the direction that its parents had. We always think that, by the way, that the next generation is not quite up to speed, but the idea behind No Country for Old Men is that the world has changed dramatically and is passing us by, and the best thing we can do is lay down. Thank you.